Okay, so as is obvious, this is the Anarchist Communism and History Struggle meeting. My name is Chris. I work in social care and I'm also a member of Collective Action. This presentation is going to take roughly 35 to 40 minutes, depending on how long I ramble on. I'm hoping that there'll be about 10, 15 minutes for questions and discussions after. And we might be able to take a little bit more time because the presentation after this is also a Collective Action one, so we shouldn't run over that time slot, but we can use the 10 minutes in between to have a bit more of a discussion. Okay.
Yes.
So, these are the key themes of the presentation that I'm going to be going over today. Essentially, I want to put forward the idea here that anarchist communism is a form of libertarian socialism that emerged in the second half of the 19th century, that it's an ideology that's rooted in the work of Bakunin and the Social Democratic Alliance, and that through this they established an international tradition known as anarchist communism that strived against social and economic inequality and against hierarchy, specifically capitalism, landlordism and the state. That this was a tradition that was orientated towards the mobilisation of the working class and peasantry, and the organisation of revolutionary societies within the working class, and that this is a tradition which has enjoyed periodic influence, although waning in the contemporary context. So essentially, we should leave the presentation with the idea that anarchist communism is a clear and definable tradition, that has an organisationalist and a popular orientation, and it has enjoyed episodes of influence. For this lecture, I've chosen two illustrative topics. The first is the life of Bakunin, and that's to kind of look at where anarchist communism starts. The second is to look at the Ukrainian Revolution as basically a kind of a simple illustration of anarchist communism in practice. I want to emphasise that anarchist communism is a very diverse and broad tradition. It's not confined to the West by any means. It's definitely not confined to the lives of straight white men. I've just chosen to use these topics because they're particularly illustrative. They also seem to highlight the idea that theory and practice is an interrelated dynamic, and I think that comes out through both these examples. And then I'll finish by looking at anarchist communism today and the contemporary movement, and hopefully that will help set the context for some of the theoretical concepts that will be covered in the next presentation. Okay, so the first subject is Mikhail Bakunin, who is widely known as the father of anarchism, not strictly anarchist communist, but as I go on to explain, a lot of his ideas inform the kind of shape of anarchist communism. So Bakunin's life, I think, is emblematic of a certain ethic that follows anarchist ideas and practice. It's a life developed to struggle, but also developed to education and the development of theory, and these were ideas that were earned through revolutionary experience, through direct interaction with the struggles of the working class and the peasantry. So I'm going to go for a brief kind of biographical sketch, which I think illustrates the important episodes of his life. He was born in 1814 to a noble but not particularly wealthy family. They were serf-owning but didn't have much money. Like many sons of the aristocracy, he was enlisted into a military academy, but he was expelled for poor grades, and following this and a row with his family, he abandons the army to pursue philosophy, to study philosophy in Moscow. Now, Bakunin is often dismissed as either an anti-intellectual or a non-intellectual character, and what I want to highlight here is actually, although he didn't have the time that Marx had to kind of systematize his writings, he is a very intellectual character. And he did leave a lot of thought for us to kind of develop and work on. Over the next few years of his life, he comes into contact with the radical ideas that are circulating in Europe over the time. Particularly, he meets Proudhon and Marx and the kind of the early formation of the First International. As a result of this and his kind of involvement with radical circles, in December 1844, the Russian emperor issues a decree stripping him of his noble privileges, confiscating his inheritance in Russia, and condemning him to lifelong exile in Serbia should he be caught. He wasn't caught at that time, but he would be caught later. Despite this, he throws himself into activity. He plays a leading role in the May Uprising in Dresden, which is pictured here, in 1849, and he helps organise the defence of the barricades during that revolution. But as a result of that, he's captured and spends the next 7 years under imprisonment, three of which are spent underground in the fortress of St. Peter and Paul. Now, this is a really terrible ordeal. Not many people survive the imprisonment in the fortress. And he loses all of his teeth due to scurvy as a result of his time in prison. And he famously had a really awful breath, but that was because basically the imprisonment completely ravaged his body. He's basically, when the emperor changes, he's granted amnesty and sent into exile in Siberia. He escapes, and despite the kind of effect on his health and the fact that he's a wanted man, he becomes involved in revolutionary activity again, joining movements in Italy, France, and England. He attempts to join the Polish insurrection in 1862, using an alias to travel, but unfortunately his ship is seized by Swedish authorities en route. In 1867, he joins the League of Peace and Freedom, which was an organisation that was kind of founded to counter the militarist trends that were developing in Europe. It was kind of like a kind of stop the war coalition of the 19th century. So lots of kind of bourgeois intellectuals, pacifist, religious types involved in this. He nonetheless becomes involved. He's very enthusiastic about it, and at this point he advocates federalist socialism for the first time, and he sits on the Central Committee. He later breaks with this group, but I'll go into that later. Now, his most renowned activity, the one that Bakunin is most known for, which is of course the split with Marx in the First International, actually only encompasses the last 8 years of his life. He joins the First International in 1868. His popular activity doesn't cease at that point. He leads, independent of the International, he leads a failed uprising in Lyon in 1870. He's very instrumental in that. He also establishes sections of the International in Italy and Spain. But Bakunin's anti-authoritarian majority increasingly comes into conflict with Marx's supporters, leading to Bakunin's expulsion in his absence at the Hague Congress in 1872. Now, this of course, is a famous event because it ends the unitary alliance of socialist factions. And there's never before this point a body in which anarchists and socialists cooperate in the way that they have here. Now, his supporters form the Saint-Imier International in 1872, and this actually outlasts the Marxist wing by a year. He retires to Switzerland in 1873, and he dies 3 years later, aged 62. So he's a very busy man. But throughout all of this, we see the development of political thought, and his ideas are changing and adapting to circumstances. So Bakunin is understood as the father of actually many traditions, only one of which is anarchist communism. And this is because Bakunin's thought cannot be really characterised as singular throughout his life. It's constantly evolving. For example, as I mentioned earlier, he very enthusiastically endorses the League of Peace and Freedom. But when they move to reject the principle of social and economic inequality, which was so important to him, he basically wrote them off and said they were completely useless. Very early in his life, he had a very strong optimism for the national liberation struggles that were going on, particularly the idea of the unity of the Slavic peoples. Again, later on in his life, he sees the limits of nationalism and moves against that. In the middle of life, he becomes very attached to federalist socialism, probably because of the influence of Proudhon. But this is kind of mixed in with the class analysis of Marx, who is actually quite a big intellectual influence on Bakunin. And finally, from 1867 onwards, he he basically endorses his own brand of what he calls collectivist anarchism. He's also credited as an influence on the Russian leftist traditions, particularly populism, as well as syndicalism and, of course, anarchist communism. Now, collectivism is what he most clearly advocated as his own philosophy, and this is, in his own words, a system in which social wealth is produced by labour and no one shares in it unless they have contributed to production. So essentially the idea of a society organised on the basis of shared wealth according to your ability to work. Now he believes this is a society that would be organised through the workers' own productive associations and free communes. From this idea you can see the influence of syndicalism and Bakunin's notion that, again in his words, the natural organisation of the masses is the organisation by trade association, is taken up by the Spanish sections of the International under his influence and become very important in the beginning of the 1900s, where the Spanish anarchists form the anarcho-syndicalist CNT and the impact that has on the Spanish Revolution. But Bakunin also lays down organisational theories for anarchists throughout his lifetime. And the idea of a conscious and revolutionary minority steering popular organisations and playing a radicalising role is key to the anarchist-communist understanding of practice. So particularly the Social Democratic Alliance essentially provides a model of how anarchist-communists later think about operating, and that will be covered in the second presentation. Okay, so the legacy. There's lots of misconceptions associated with Bakunin. The two most common ones are that he was a serial schemer and a fantasist, something which may be partially true, and the second that he was a closet authoritarian, which is untrue. Now, Bakunin did advocate secret societies in his intellectual writings. But this has to be understood in the context of the repression that he operated under and clearly suffered from. Trade unions, for example, over the period of his lifetime were organised as secret societies. So this was not an unusual thing that he was advocating in terms of the context of the leftist movement. It should also be noted that the organisation that Bakunin had the strongest influence over, the Social Democratic Alliance, was not secret. And was actually designed to have a very open, radicalising influence on the International. Now, while Bakunin had many supporters around him who corresponded privately, and this was the case for Marx, Proudhon, many figures within the International, the Bakunin's supposed secret alliance, which was called the International Brotherhood, only existed as a set of ideas. So essentially he drafted out a programme for an organisation that didn't end up existing. Now, it's from this programme of the International Brotherhood that we have the accusation that he's a closet authoritarian, because in this he uses this phrase, the invisible dictatorship, to describe how the organisation operates. Now, I think this term needs to be understood carefully, and it needs to be contextualised in terms of the analysis he puts in the rest of that document. Bakunin actually states in the programme of the International Brotherhood that this revolutionary alliance excludes any controlling and directive power. Rather, what he is talking about is a well-organized society composed of dedicated, energetic, and intelligent individuals who can serve as intermediaries between revolutionary ideas and the popular instinct. So we talked about is the kind of general staff of revolution, but not in a commanding sense, but more in what we contemporary anarchist communists would call exercising a leadership of ideas. A leadership of influence. There are other negative aspects of his legacy, one of which is he did display both anti-Semitic and anti-Germanic sentiments in his quarrels with Marx. These should be criticised, unreservedly so, and noted as contrary to almost the rest of his thought. Also, Bakunin's collectivism is ultimately an incomplete vision of an anarchist society. Now, the next generation of anarchists, Carlo Caffiero, Peter Kropotkin, recognised that this was a problem. They actually abstained from criticising him while he was still alive out of respect. But they basically reformulated the social anarchist principle to, instead of ability to work, each according to their need. Other positive aspects of Bakunin's legacy is very early establishes the intersectionality of anarchism, arguing that the struggle for a free society is inseparable from the struggle for women's rights, also against the oppression of the church and the freedom of people's cultures. Finally, the anti-authoritarian sections of the International that Bakunin helped to establish in Italy and Spain flourished after his death and actually turned into mass organisations, which is contrary to what happened to a lot of Marxist sections. Okay, so my second example, I'm going to take a big break. I can feel my voice going already. I'm just drinking too much black coffee. The Ukrainian Revolution. This period in history is basically designed to illustrate, however imperfectly, what anarchist communism can be applied in practice. So it's not a very well-known episode, so I thought it was useful to explain kind of the origins, where this come from, what was going on. So the Ukrainian Revolution has to be understood within the context of the Russian Revolution. And many of the social transformations that were happening across Russia in 1917 were also spreading to the Ukraine. So we have the formation of popular Soviets, peasant congresses and factory councils moving across the country, and the growing influence of both communist and anarchist ideas throughout the Ukraine. Now, the October Revolution in Russia creates a political vacuum in the Ukraine. Now, the Russian Empire basically previously claimed Ukraine as Russian territory. When the government changes, there's basically a question mark as to what is the political status of Ukraine, who is in control of it. The Social Democratic Party in Ukraine uses this opportunity to declare an independent Ukrainian state. But as a result of the radicalizing activity in the north, the Bolsheviks basically push them out, seeking to establish Soviet power across Ukraine. This leads the Social Democrats to seek the support of the German and Austro-Hungarian empires, who basically disperse them and install a puppet nationalist dictatorship in control of those empires. Throughout all of this, popular resistance by worker and peasant militias continues in the Ukraine, essentially defending the gains of the social revolution. That is until the signing of the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk by the Bolsheviks, which cedes the Ukraine to the German Empire. Now, as part of this peace treaty that the Bolsheviks established with the Germans, it basically loads of territory is given over to them, and that includes the Ukraine. And that means there's no more Red Army support in Ukraine. So the popular militias and the partisans are essentially left on their own. Now, it's in this context that Nestor Makhno, who is pictured here, and his insurrectionary anarchist army emerges as a force of resistance against both the nationalist and the German forces, but later on as against the Bolsheviks as well. The army itself numbered between 15,000 and 110,000 personnel, and throughout this time the territories were shifting, but the idea was the army was designed to carve out a space for the social revolution in Ukraine. So this is Nestor Makhno in the centre. He earned a nickname in the 1920s. His most famous nickname is Batko, which means father. But he also earned another nickname, which was Mali, I think is how he pronounced it, which basically means shorty. And you can see he's a little bit shorter than everyone else in the picture. I think that's why he wears such tall hats. But also the other interesting thing about this picture is if you look at the soldiers on the right of the frame, he's wearing what is typical anarchist militia dress, which is longer hair and basically cobbled together uniforms from various things that they'd either stolen or where soldiers had mutinied, they adopted. So it was almost like a stylistic choice that they decided to look different than the nationalist militias and the Red Army. They'd have this kind of more bohemian style.
Punks.
Yeah, basically. This is the Free Territory of Ukraine. So the bit in the red is the area that the anarchists establish as kind of a free zone. It's kind of hard to tell for that picture, but it's about, if you put England on its side, that's about the space that it takes up. So it's a pretty sizable territory. It's very agrarian. There were a few areas of industry around Gallipoli, but a lot of it was peasant holdings and landed estates. Okay, so as I said before, in the Free Territory of the Ukraine, a lot of the work that did happen was constrained by the circumstances. There were shifting borders throughout this period, and the war often left little room for constructive work. But the activity that did go on could be divided into broadly two categories. The first is the extension of the revolution that was already happening in Russia, and the second was the organisation of new anarchist initiatives. The Makhnovists were a little less successful, the latter, or it kind of happened on a smaller scale. But I think most of that can be attributed to the fact that the Free Territory was only at that size for a very short period of time. So during this period, the Nabat Confederation of Anarchist Organizations, which was the Ukrainian Anarchist Revolutionary Society, emerged as an organ of political influence, helping to organize social revolutionary products throughout the Free Territory. Now, this was an organization that was separate from the military, but there was some crossover in membership. So Makhno was a commander of the army, but also a member of the Nabat. So in terms of the activity that did happen, from 1917, all land, equipment and livestock around Gallipoli was transferred to peasant organisations. The few small factories that were there were functioned under workers' control, and landed estates were split up in preparation for agricultural communes. There were four of these free communes, involving around 300 people in the same area. Here the land was worked equally, and all decisions made by General Assembly. These did involve collective living, but you can contrast them to the forced collectivizations that the Bolsheviks later implemented, in the sense that they allowed people to have their private space as well. So you would eat communally, you would socialize communally, but you also had your own living space if you choose it. The Makhnovists organized local congresses of the regional Soviets to help coordinate the revolution nationally. Now the Bolsheviks refused to recognize these and accused any participation in what were called free congresses of treason. But these free Soviets actually are very important in establishing the governance of the Free Territory. Educational work happens throughout the countryside. There's the promotion of anarchist education, also the organization of peasant entertainment, such as popular plays. But I think the important thing to establish is that this was, first off, while in a state of war, and secondly, without recourse to the authoritarian measures that Lenin and Trotsky were arguing were necessary to extend the revolution in Russia. For example, freedom of speech, association and the press was encouraged in the Free Territory, as opposed to papers and presses being shut down. The only thing that the Makhnovists banned was the formation of the revolutionary committees that the Bolsheviks were using in Russia to control the popular Soviets. So every other activity was essentially permitted, the rationale being that they felt the anarchist ideas were strong enough, it didn't really matter if there was a bourgeois paper promoting right-wing ideas, because the social revolution would convince people in practice. So, it's a little known fact that anarchists have contributed to military technological innovation. This is a Tachanka, which is essentially a machine gun strapped to a wagon. But no one thought of doing this before Nestor Makhno incorporated it into the insurrectionary army. So these were very important as part of their fighting force, and actually allowed him to be very mobile. It had a lot of mounted troops as well, so this combined with his mounted forces allowed him to move across the countryside very quickly. This is Maria Nikiforova, who wasn't actually a Makhnovist, but she was an anarchist communist and a Ukrainian. And she actually established her own militia during this period called the Free Combat Drazina, which helped to establish Soviet power in the southern Ukraine, very similar to the Makhno. She also fell out of favor with the Bolsheviks, but she's notable for being the only female commander within all the red or black forces throughout this period. She later kind of joins, her militia becomes disarmed by the Bolsheviks, and she later kind of becomes part of Makhno's inner circle and his kind of political commissar later on, but she never kind of joins formally the army. So the military, the Insurrectionary Army of Ukraine operates by three key principles. Voluntary enlistment, election of all commanders, and self-discipline. And that's self-discipline as opposed to military discipline. All decisions are made at mass assemblies by soldiers. Now occasionally the electoral principle is violated by Makhno in that he chooses commanders, but this is only done in condition that consensus is with the troops, that this is allowed to be done. Army commanders are accountable to the regional workers, peasants and soldiers' congresses and confined only to carrying out their instructions. Women also fought alongside the men in the ranks, so this is an area that's hasn't had much scholarly investigation, so we kind of need to find out more about female Makhnovists. Makhno very successfully exploits mutinies in the Red Army. Red Army men are kind of disillusioned because of, one, the retreat from Ukraine, but also because of the increasing military discipline that's used by Trotsky. So many of them end up joining the anarchist militia, and he's very successfully incorporates large amounts of troops very quickly from the Bolsheviks. Makhno's treatment of prisoners throughout this period is distinct compared to a lot of the other commanders, in the sense that commanders, he gives ordinary troops who he's been fighting the choice of either disarming themselves or joining him. He doesn't employ mass executions or imprison anyone. Makhno's forces also play a really critical role in the Russian Civil War, in the sense that General Denikin's forces, the Whites, when they threaten to overrun Moscow, it's actually Makhno's army that intervenes and stops the advance on Moscow. So the anarchists actually play a kind of quite critical role in the success of the Bolsheviks in the north. Yet in spite of this, the Bolsheviks are frustrated with Makhno's autonomy, their lack of political control over him, and the fact that the anarchist program does not fit with the Bolshevik program. As a result of this, they repeatedly they set up alliances with the anarchists when it's expedient to do so, and break them when they have opportunity to as well. There's also several attempts made on Makhno's life by Red Army spies, and on a number of occasions, Makhno sends people to negotiate with the Bolsheviks, and the Bolsheviks either end up imprisoning or executing his delegates. So, what kind of legacy does this leave? Well, a contested history, undoubtedly. Largely because this period is principally animated by Soviet historiography. These stories are mostly told by Russian historians who were working within the Soviet Union and had a vested interest in downplaying or dismissing the events that were happening. I believe it does show an alternative was possible without needing to resort to the centralization of authority, state terror, or secret police to defend the social revolution. Now, after the Ukrainian revolution ends, Makhno and other Ukrainian and Russian exiles basically seek to bring forward the conclusions from both the successes and failures of the revolution. Now, this results in this document, which is the organizational platform of the General Union of Anarchists. This puts forward the idea, the authors propose the idea of an organisation of the anarchist movement into a unified and self-disciplined union devoted to social work within the masses. Something which I think follows the best practices of both the Makhnovist and then the Bat throughout the Free Territory in the Ukrainian Revolution. Okay, so finally, looking at anarchist communism today. There has been a contemporary trend within anarchism to conflate anarchist and anarchist communist ideas with certain lifestyle or fashion choices, dropout culture, or so-called ethical practices, the ethical shopping, ethical buying, blah, blah, blah. Now, although undoubtedly anarchists have always encouraged cultural, artistic, and aesthetic practices, this was always principally as an offshoot of a movement of social struggle. You know, I mentioned earlier about the kind of fashion of the anarchist militias. It's only really in terms of a movement of social struggle that it's possible that we can speak of anarchist communism today. Unfortunately, it's become necessary to continually redefine this, despite the fact that this tradition is very clearly outlined in terms of the legacy of just those two events, but many other episodes of anarchist organizing. So, to finish off, I'm looking to anarchismo as a best example of this tradition in contemporary practice. Now, anarchismo is a global coordination of anarchist communist groups aimed to improve organization and communications with those with shared ideas and practices. Now, collective action considers itself very close to this tradition and very close to anarchismo. More importantly, anarchismo share the idea of recapturing anarchism's what is called the social vector. And by this we mean returning anarchism to its traditional place as a current that engages and emerges with social struggles and shapes popular movements for social transformation. Essentially, we argue that anarchism has always done this. Anarchism has always been defined by interaction and involvement in popular struggles, and it's necessary to redefine and recapture this legacy and actually practice the anarchist communism that we know exists. Okay, so many of those are going to be covered in more detail, those kind of theoretical concepts, in the next presentation. So to reiterate the key themes: anarchist communism, clear and definable tradition with an organisationist and popular orientation, which has enjoyed episodes of influence throughout its history. That's it. Exactly 35 minutes. So, I'm happy to have an open discussion, but does anyone have any questions about the presentation specifically? Otherwise, I'm happy to just leave it for a free-flowing discussion. Yeah.
I think quite really like the idea of the betrayal of the Ukraine. You know, the betrayal.
Yeah.
I don't think they really wanted to give Ukraine to the Germans. It was forced upon them, wasn't it? It was almost like saying, if a woman's being raped, that she had a choice. She didn't have a choice.
I think
the word betrayal, sounded a bit overcooking it.
Well, I suppose it depends what. I think it depends about objectives. So, the Bolshevik objective was to consolidate a Bolshevik state in Russia, and to do that, it may have been necessary to negotiate with the Germans on that basis. The Makhnovist objective was to extend the social revolution. And in terms of those objectives, then I don't think ceding territory or negotiating with the Germans was necessary. Makhno waged a very successful campaign against the Whites. In many ways, the kind of Bolshevik victory was against the anarchists was laid out by the fact that his forces had been depleted and worn out by the struggle against nationalists. So I think he showed it was possible to fight the kind of civil war, but not on in terms of the way the Bolsheviks did it.
All I'm trying to say is that, you know, I don't think the Bolsheviks wanted to betray the Ukraine. That's all, you know, it was forced upon them.
I think there was also
maybe could argue there were a range of options, but
yeah,
I think the betrayal to me sounds a bit, you know, it sounds like a conscious decision to, you know, stick the boot into the Ukraine or whatever it is.
Okay, I mean, yeah, okay, that may be fair. I think there is a question about politics here, in the sense that the Bolsheviks were well aware that the anarchist and SR, particularly social revolutionary influence, was much stronger in the Ukraine, so they cared about it less. The policies following the kind of fall of the Ukrainian Revolution, the policies that Lenin and then Stalin pursues against the Ukraine can only really be described as punitive, that they are punishing towards the Ukraine. So I think there is, maybe not at the moment, but there is a degree of kind of, essentially the Ukraine was never really a solid base for Bolshevism, and the Bolsheviks essentially punished the people because of those mixed affiliations. Yeah.
Do you know if there was like any currencies or any form of money or like labour checks used in the Free Territory?
It was very small scale, the collectivizations that did take place. And the process of communization wasn't complete. So you had like hybrid economies. Also, like the requisition of resources and weaponry in particular was often mediated by the Bolsheviks, and that was often based on credentials rather than money. So Makhno in particular was actually able to procure a lot of his weaponry early on, because he was a commander and a well-known figure within the Red Guards, before sort of outing himself very publicly as an anarchist. Everyone who had sort of credentials as a Red Guard commander, it would list their political affiliation, and Makhno's famously didn't list that he was an anarchist, and that's probably the reason why he was able to get as far as he did, because a lot of people who did were very quickly imprisoned or exiled or killed. The modes of distribution they did practice were basically communal, along the lines of the theories that Kropotkin advocated, the idea of kind of the countryside bringing produce to the cities to exchange freely, so not mediated by money. They did, even though there were lots of complaints about Makhnovis sort of being sort of anti-city or against kind of city workers, they did, when the news came that the workers were starving in St. Petersburg, peasant farmers in the Free Territory arranged for the free provision of goods to the St. Petersburg city workers, basically on the understanding that, you know, we'll give you our produce and you'll repay the favour at some point by, you know, giving us machinery or, you know, goods they were able to produce. So it's not stable, and money obviously continues to exist, but where they're able to establish those communist practices, they are fully communist. There's no labour vouchers or kind of similar things which did happen in the Spanish Revolution. Does anybody else have any questions or comments?
What happened to Makhno in the end?
It's quite a tragic story, really. He was pushed out of the Ukraine, and for a while, partisan units were active in Romania, Siberia. I'm trying to think of the adjoining country. Sorry, it was Romania. Yeah, so there were Makhnovist detachments active in Romania. He goes to Europe, and that's where he writes the platform. But he essentially descends into alcoholism,
right,
and dies very young. He does have contact with lots of influential people. Like, there's a picture of him with Alexander Berkman in Paris. But he had this kind of like nine lives thing. Like, he should have died so many times throughout the revolution. He somehow survived, and I can't remember who it was, but there's an anecdote about when he was in Europe, and they basically said, you know, it's like he's got holes in him. He'd been shot so many times. He had like scars and holes all over his body. He basically became completely disillusioned and ended up being dying quite young. Which is unfortunate.
Just a quick thing. I remember very little, I've read about Matthew as well, saying that one of the things that made his forces stand out as well as not executing or imprisoning prisoners of war, compared to all the other forces, Macmillan was very, very harsh on anti-Semitism and pogroms, and similarly with issues of rape and that kind of thing. I just wasn't sure if that was factual or less.
He was accused of being anti-Semitic, and the Macnovists were accused of being anti-Semitic, but there's no real evidence to support that they were. It was mainly the right wing and the Bolshevik presses that were spreading that rumour. There was also he did arrange a conference with one of the nationalist leaders, basically under the pretense of negotiating an alliance, but that was essentially a trick. He ends up having a kind of co-speech with him on a stage and then shooting him with a revolver at the end of the session. So it's like he did formally enter into an alliance, but it was basically to kill him. He punished anti-Semitic sentiment within his troops very harshly, probably too harshly, in the sense that there's a... It's going to make him sound really trigger happy now, but there is like another incident where he basically executed a soldier on the spot for putting up anti-Semitic posters in a village. He did actually get reprehended by the Free Soviets, reprimanded by the Free Soviets for doing that. Kind of like, you shouldn't have really done that. But I think those kind of things are quite reassuring to me, that it shows that those checks and balances were there to a degree. I mean, one of the topics that I didn't cover was the Macnovists did actually set up a secret service like the Bolsheviks, like the Cheka, called the Kontrazvedka. And they had an internal and an external section. And the external section was basically counterintelligence, espionage. There's speculation that a lot of the anarchist terrorism that was happening against the Bolsheviks in Russia was the result of Macnovist intelligence operatives. But they did have an internal section, and that was basically, its function was very similar to the Cheka in the sense that it was meant to quell counter-revolutionary elements within the captured areas. But very quickly that got out of control, and there were kind of political retribution killings and kind of imprisonments, and it kind of became clear that it was going to descend into kind of a red terror situation. Now this was discussed at the popular congresses, and actually as a result of the decision at the popular congress, that section was disbanded, which I just think it's interesting to see how that kind of democratic structure can then kind of check the excesses of warfare, whereas under the Bolsheviks, the Cheka became more and more and more powerful in many ways. Okay, maybe one more question if anyone has any. Okay. All right, we'll leave it there. We'll take a 10-minute break before the next presentation. The next one covers the kind of theoretical concepts that emerge from this kind of tradition. I'm going to also be on the collective action stall for most of the rest of the day, so if anyone wants to talk to me about stuff that's in here that they don't understand or would like to debate on, then I'm happy to chat to them on the collective action stall. But thank you for coming to my presentation.
Thank you. Cheers.